Good evening and welcome to the Cycles of Change radio program. Today we're welcoming William Whitecloud, author of The Last Shaman. William Whitecloud, Australia's number one best-selling author of The Magician's Way, has launched this latest work, The Last Shaman, which brings his insightful Living from Greatness transformational workshops to the United States. This work is an adventure story set in war-torn Swaziland in Africa. The Last Shaman is also a truly transformative shamanic journey that has some have called a cross between Indiana Jones and Carlos Castaneda. I like to think of it as a cross between James Redfield and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. It has all the intrigue of the Celestine Prophecies, yet is written in the quality style of writing that you find in the story of Sherlock Holmes. This book is a teaching tool designed, like Whitecloud's work, to deepen the appreciation and understanding of the reader's intuition and how they can use it to live soul-inspired lives. In The Magician's Way, described as Jonathan Livingston Seagull on steroids by Paul Dunn, chairman of BIGI Incorporated, has had a major impact on people all over the world, The Last Shaman is set to start a revolution. Well, it started a revolution in me because I found this to be one of the most spellbinding books I've read, including anything from contemporary novels to the classics. This is a story I heartily recommend each of you to read. And with us now is author of The Last Shaman, William Whitecloud. William, are you there?
I'm here, David. How could I not be after an introduction like that? Thank you so much.
I am so pleased to be speaking with you. First of all, William, I just want to say the writing quality. These days, not everybody can even put a sentence together, but the style with which you have written this book creates a great medium for us to be taken on a journey of a lifetime. Get Steven Spielberg on the phone. I want to see the film.
That's what everybody says. You know, the book is, and the book that I write, which is quite amazing. You know, the first one you mentioned, The Magician's Way, became Australia's best-selling physical book ever. Very popular, and I hope that The Last Shaman will follow, because I think the message of The Last Shaman is equally, if not more, important. But, you know, I can't write to save my life. If you had to put a gun to my head and sit me down and, you know, if my life depended on writing anything of quality, I could not do it. I'm not educated. I have no training. I have no idea of how to write anything. But, you know, the way I live my life and the way I teach people to live their lives by and what I teach through my books is a super conscious way of living. Whereby you can, you know, get in touch with the higher side of yourself that can create in a far more effective way than you could ever rationally put together. And, you know, I just apply this very technique to whatever I do. And so this is the product of, you know, this is the product, the end product that you then read. I can't explain it and I don't understand it. It just comes out and I send it to the editor and the publishers and it comes out as a book and, there you are enjoying it. So praise to the forces that can put that together.
Well, I'm willing to concede the point that you can't write that well, because in my contention, nobody can write that well. You have to become a vessel and draw deposits to the spirit of humankind and then channel it through into what you do.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and there's a level at which I don't take credit, because I don't have the styling and the gifts and the skill or understanding of structure and anything like that. But the thing that I can credit myself for is the ability to put the structures in place that allow me to be that channel or vessel or whatever you call it. And it's really a beautiful thing. It's a great feeling. While you create in that way, it's a real joy to create in the way that way. No matter what you're creating in your life, whether it's your relationships, your businesses, your day-to-day affairs, your creative endeavors, whatever, it's a real joy to be creating in that way. And also, obviously, the end results are so brilliantly effective. They're so beautifully effective. And it, you know, it's just such a worthwhile way of well, approach to life, really. And you know, I'm very passionate about it. I've lived the other way. I've done it tough and struggled and done it, you know, being brought to my knees trying to do it the other way. And I, you know, I understand the suffering and limitations inherent in that. And then the sublime nature of this marvelously magical creative orientation that we're all capable of. And you know, I always say, often I finish a letter to people or sign off on a blog, or when I say goodbye to a group at a seminar, I always say, you know, I wish everyone a magical life, because really there's actually no reason not to live a magical life, because we're all capable of it. And you know, I'm so passionate about that, and that is my mission, is to, you know, support anyone who's willing to be on this path. I'm there to support them in actually, you know, succeeding on this way.
Well, I felt a little bit more confident, as it were, and centered just by reading this book. You know, when you talk about, we're opening up with how the book was written, but therein, the medium is the message, because at the same time, this exciting story draws us in and opens new windows to the mind, and at the same time provides a mirror to the soul. And I find myself living vicariously through the point of view of the characters therein, and I'm realizing that these unique circumstances and very imaginative situations and gorgeous scenarios are actually things that are causing your characters to tap into things that are common to us all. William, I'm going to ask you, there's a little bit of crackling in your phone when you speak. I'm going to ask if you could hang up and dial back while I read a few paragraphs that I have here that tell a little bit about your work. It'll only take you a minute to do that. I think you might come in a little clearer.
Is it still crackling? Because, you know, I had this, inadvertently, I had the speakerphone on. Is it all right now?
I still hear a little bit of crackling.
Okay. I'll call back.
All right, and I'll do a little reading in the meantime. Thank you, William.
Okay.
Well, folks, we're going to get into this story here a little bit as a precursor to your reading it, because I trust a lot of you are going to take the advice here of yours truly, your host, David Katzmar, to tell you that if you read one book that I've ever advised from all the authors that have been on this program, very worthwhile authors, read this one, The Last Shaman. So let me tell you a little bit of some of the write-ups we have on this. William Whitecloud is a super successful creator and an extraordinary communicator. His passion and purpose in life is to educate others in the reality that they have the power to create whatever they love in every situation and moment. This calling was born out of his own rich experience of transforming his life from circumstances of crushing despair to becoming a creative to tens of thousands of people around the world. In the late 80s, with his life at rock bottom, William was compelled to embark on a quest to discover what it would take to create what he truly wanted, a rich life in health, wealth, love, and creative expression. This search brought William into contact with the alchemical principles of Hermetic philosophy and the ideas of Robert Fritz, founder of Technologies for Creating. Both modalities pointed to the premise that we can direct the subconscious mind to create the reality we choose. After completely turning around the negative circumstances in his life, William was inspired to found Living from Greatness, a personalized course dedicated to empowering participants in discovering and living their highest potential. He has worked with thousands of people on every continent, both one-on-one and in groups, coaching them in bringing their dreams into reality. His near 20-year search to discern the essence of what it takes for people to connect and live from their creative spirit forms the basis of his work. First revealed in his top personal development book in Australia, The Magician's Way, and now in his new release, The Last Shaman, he now lives in San Francisco, where he devotes his time to coaching, writing, enjoying family, and letting life unfold by magic. And we're going to talk a little bit about magic. So, folks, William Whitecloud, back with us again and reconnected. William, how are we sounding now?
Well, you tell me. I apologize. I think it may have been caused by the fact that I had my speakerphone on. So how's it sounding to you?
It's sounding like it. I'm glad it was crackling because it gave us a moment to read a little bit about the work. So, William, synchronicity at play here. Yeah, you can figure things out like that when you read The Last Shaman. You don't even have to use long words like that either. You just be. But in any case, William, would you tell us a little bit about the story of The Last Shaman?
Sure. It's really interesting because I'll just say this about the story, if I may, just very quickly, because you were saying what an impact it had on you, and everyone reports that. Everyone reports that I've spoken to so far and gotten feedback from reports that in reading the story, there's a point where they lose touch with that they're reading a story about a character other than themselves and feel like that they are the central character in the story. And, you know, it's really a magical result that, but it is also goes to the power of storytelling and conveying principles through the vehicle of story, because now scientists tell us that actually we don't know the difference between a story, you know, that's happening to someone else and a story that's happening to us, which is why when we're in the theater and you know, someone's going into a room and there's the scary music playing, we shout out, don't go into that room, you know, because we feel like it's us. We get caught up in it, and so when you take on a lesson through the vehicle of story, it's like it's actually happening to you. So you actually practice the lessons yourself, and so they, just by reading a story, I mean, you still then have to practice the principles, but a lot can be transferred just in the reading of the story, and that's why it's just such a great medium. But the story of The Last Shaman is a great story, because I wanted to convey these principles that are conveyed in The Last Shaman, which basically about how one, you know, can be guided along the path of your highest destiny, to be able to connect with the guidance that's always there. We're all being guided all of the time. And having that ability to connect with that guidance, and then also having the will to follow that guidance and live in accordance with our highest possibility, our highest destiny, you know, is an art. And I really have studied this art and have an appreciation, live by it, teach people to live by it, and wanted to convey it through the medium of a story. It's very, very tricky thing to convey tangible, palpable ideas and lessons without interrupting the flow of a story. So it's got to be a really great story. And I was looking for a great story for a long time. And what happened was, I was in South Africa visiting my brother, and he introduced me to Africa's foremost rock art expert, a man who studies Bushman paintings that, by the way, go back even 27,000 years to caves in Spain of the same people that occupied, you know, that roamed across southern Europe and then through all of Africa right down to the southern tip of Africa. And he took me out into the field and showed me these paintings, some of them dating back 6,000 years. And what was remarkable about these paintings was what good condition they were in. I mean, if you think that these paintings were painted by people who had only ochre, mud ochre, and sticks to paint with, and actually three colors. I've since learned only use three colors, white, black, and red ochre. But using that palette created this amazing range of color, and created amazing paintings that have preserved on these walls for, well, you know, 6,000 years or longer. And the one painting I saw, which was 6,000 years old, was photographic in quality, just brilliant. And here's the thing about the story is that I learned, because, you know, when I was a kid growing up, David, I used to see Bushman paintings a lot of places. And in our ignorance, we just thought they were the stories of clan warfare or, the hunting trophies of the clans. Mm-hmm. So you know, painted on the wall. So these primitive people painting stories about, or pictures of what they'd killed, and, you know, the war stories, the stories of the wars they'd been in. But when this guy explained it to me, when Victor, the bush painting expert, explained these paintings to me, I was really enlightened in a brilliant way, because what he explained was that in every single case, these are depictions of a shaman's journey into the other world. And the animals that you see are not actually the animals they killed, but they're totem animals, the animals that they get their spiritual energy from to have the energy to go into the other world and then organize the other world and harmonize the other world in such a way that they create a corresponding harmony in our world, so that they can make rain, or they can heal a person, or divine wisdom, whatever's called for. And so the depictions of what look like war is actually them fighting evil spirits on the other side, you see. And so there's this whole tableau, there's this whole tapestry of them, you know, going into trance, going through the crack in the wall into the other world, organizing the other world, doing battle there, coming back and affecting whatever good they want to affect on this side. And it's, you know, I was just blown away by everything, by the stories. You know, just my imagination was so fired by the idea of these people going on these quests and coming back and, you know, affecting change in this way by going into another dimension, into a subconscious dimension, and then creating the order that then translates into whatever we want to create on you know, in self-conscious waking reality. But also the amazing thing about it was that for the most part, these shamans never trained in painting. Typically, they only ever painted one painting in their life. So they'd go and they'd have this experience, and then now and then they'd have just such an unusual experience that they'd be, you know, motivated, they'd be inspired to actually depict it and paint it like it was a vision board of theirs or something, and without any prior knowledge of painting experience or whatever, fired up, inspired, divinely inspired, they'd go off and collect materials, and in this trance state that they would still be in, they'd paint these brilliant paintings, which were just, you know, almost in some cases so photographic and enduring as well, miraculous. And so, you know, I just thought, what if I could take a modern day character and in some way send them on this journey, send them into the other world, transport them into the other world. Not necessarily literally another world, but a place really foreign to them that was just as good as another world, where they would have to overcome the challenges and, you know, sort themselves out in a way that when they came back to their own life and their normal life, that they would be changed, and the world that they lived in also correspondingly would be changed. And so that's the story of The Last Shaman, is about the character. It's a sequel to The Magician's Way, my first book, where, you know, in the first book, in The Magician's Way, Mark Vail learns about the mechanics of creating and manifesting and actually living in a way that's in accordance with the heart. And so what is left out of The Magician's Way is really the tools for applying the intuition, applying the wisdom that really fuels the mechanics of creating. And so Mark Vail has yet to learn these tools and these techniques and this deeper understanding and deeper wisdom. And so through the vehicle of this shamanic journey, he goes into, on this journey and into this world where he learns these tools and you know, essentially discovers how one is being guided all the time and how one can flow with that guidance and you know, be in the flow and be led along the path that's leading and always flowing in alignment with our highest destiny and our, you know, our highest potential.
And that is the teaching that we must all learn. There's an old saying that goes, it takes one to know one. And when we're not aware of ourselves, when we're not aware of divinity, the universe, or what have you, we're not going to be aware of the subtle signs, all the time, and we're not going to be aware of the awakened essence in someone else when we meet them. We've got to realize it in ourselves first, and yet it's there.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, each one of us has a heart. Each one of us has a divinity. I mean, at the end of the day, what we are made of, who we really are, is pure creative spirit connected to everything through all time and space. And, you know, that is the basis of our creative power and our intuitive power. And we are all that, although we assume disguises of separation and, you know, relative powerlessness. Actually, behind the masks, each one of us is, you know, a continuation of our connected form, basically. And you know, it's a really powerful thing to recognize within yourself, but also then to start assuming in others. Life somehow becomes far more joyful, but also effective. When, funnily enough, if you begin to relating to other people as powerful, first of all, and then also as ultimately well-meaning, you know, some people would say good, it really is an attitude that will stand one in really good stead in terms of what your, you know, your, of a heightened experience in life, actually.
The medium is the message in this book, because you were had a moment of learning and inspiration that led you to write a story about Mark Vail, the lead character, who had a journey of learning and realization. And in the process of our reading it, the result is we go through a journey of learning and realization. And so my question was to you, there is a magic that comes through here. We're touching upon it a little bit here and there. When you mentioned the paintings that were used as teaching tools some 6,000 years ago, and the journey that goes on in the Last Shaman, it reaches for magical things, and the characters in the story have to conceive. Well, what is that? Coming from the left-brain cerebral methods of contemporary European American thinking and so forth, where we want to take everything literal. We don't necessarily understand things metaphorically, but sometimes you have to see them as not mutually exclusive and get beyond that concept and move on. So, William, what do you mean by magic?
Well, I think I mean two things, David. Is first of all, when I talk about magic, I'm talking about having an experience of life that is brilliant, really. I think in any language we understand and we do say, whenever we have an amazing experience in life, we always look at each other and go, wow, that was magical. That's magic. We see a brilliant sunset. We go down a brilliant ski run. And at the end of it, you know, we look at each other and go, wow, that was magical. When life flows in a way that's beyond what we could hope for, that the process that creates the end result is beyond what we could have conceived of, as well as the end result itself being far beyond what we would have hoped for. And so, you know, I think, as I said, in any language, we just go, well, that's magical. And so I'm talking about living a life in a way where that is your predominant experience. Is that you're just enthralled by life. It's the way you live and the way life turns out for you. And I believe it's possible for everyone, because it brings me to my second meaning of magic, which is just simply this, that very typically, if truth be told, our when it comes down to it, the average person's perception of themselves is, and of life as well, is actually very mechanical. And, you know, it's as though life is a set of circumstances that are thrust on us, and that the meaning of our lives is to get through those circumstances as best we can, that, you know, coping with our circumstances is what our life's about, and that, you know, the best we're going to cope with life is in a very mechanical way, which is by, you know, the strength of our physicality and also our mentality. So, you know, as strongly as we can force our way through, or as adroitly as we can use our minds to figure things out is the extent of, you know, the way we're going to cope with whatever we're faced with in life. Whereas what I think I was referred to this earlier is that what I believe, what I understand, what I know for myself is that we're actually all pure creative spirit connected to everything through all time and space. And that if we appreciate that and if we have a way of connecting with that spirit and actually handing over to our spirit or involving our creative spirit in whatever we're involved with in life and whatever we undertake, that spirit can help us create and manifest in a way far beyond what anything we could ever rationally formulate. And so, you know, therein lies also what I mean by magic.
Well, the evidence is coming forth a little bit in modern science, which in the realm of quantum physics is leaving behind the old mechanical views of the universe. Because when you get down on the subatomic level, the old rules for motion and so forth kind of break down, and things seem to have a tendency to exist at certain times until you look at them, and then they change. So we really had to throw out the old models and realize that there is more to what we're looking at. But it was first when we were looking at creation with modern quantum physics that we could get new concepts, because it broke us out of our old and we began to understand beyond creation and contemplate the creator. And when we did that, we realized that we really are part of everything. And that's why I think you've tapped into this. You know, you talk about the 6,000-year-old paintings that were done in meticulous, startling detail from painters who hadn't painted anything. And that might sound a bit absurd. I find it as unbelievable as somebody who hasn't written anything penning the most popular book ever sold in the continent. Oh, wait, that's already happened. You know, also reminds me of Wuthering Heights by Emily Brontë. You know what she wrote before that? Nothing. Where did it come from? Where does it come from? Well, William, if I may ask, how did you get drawn into this realization of magic?
Well, I actually, without really appreciating it for a long time, I was born into magic. You see, I was born in a country called Swaziland. In a small country in Africa, and when I was born there and grew up there, it was a very wild place. I always say, and this is true, that when my father drove out to the place that he was contracted to develop from virgin bushland into an agricultural farm, the road, well, the track he was driving on ran out 100 miles before he got where he was going. And so there wasn't a telegraph post or an electricity post for more than 100 miles. And, you know, it really was a wild place and, you know, full of all the wild animals that you could imagine, the leopards and the lions and the elephants. In fact, our farm was named after an elephant graveyard. It was situated on this massive elephant graveyard where these elephants used to come through the gorge from Mozambique to this place to actually die. It was their resting place, final resting place. And the people, you know, were living in the same way as they had lived for thousands of years before any European had ever set foot there, and were either, you know, totally undressed or if they had anything on, it was skins. And they were actually still conducting clan warfare on our farm. You know, our farm was wedged between two different clans, and so their meeting point for their disputes was right in the middle of our farm. And
yes.
You know, I still go back there today, and they largely unaffected, even as modern as they are, and they're all using cell phones and that now. That they still kind of have their worldview is very well preserved, I find, with the Swazis, but especially back then. And, you know, I mean, their worldview was nothing like ours here in the West. For the people that I grew up amongst and whose worldview I soaked in and assimilated, you know, self-conscious waking reality was an illusion. It's just something to be seen through to the deepest supernatural spiritual forces at play, you see, and so a lot of their time was spent discerning and divining what was going on those levels, because to them this waking world was a bit of an illusion, or didn't explain everything that was really going on, or was the tip of the iceberg, as it were. And so this is the worldview that I absorbed. And it was stamped out of me as soon as I got to the sort of Christian, colonial orientated boarding schools, the series of boarding schools that I went through from there. I was very quickly given to understand that this was all nonsense, and, you know, I should get with this materialistic, mechanical view of the world and, progress that we were all striving for. And so I did. But then, from my early 20s into my early 30s, I had a 10-year illness, which really took me to my deathbed. And the thing about the illness, other than it was a terribly debilitating illness, and as I say, at the end I was getting deathbed counselling, so I knew I was going to check out if something didn't happen. And the thing about it, other than it being that debilitating, was that also in 10 years, not one medical, clinical physician or alternative healer or complementary medical person could tell me what was wrong with me. I saw psychiatrists, psychologists, anything ending with an ologist, I saw them all. And if it ended in a path, I saw them too. And, you know, no one knew what was wrong with me. And then finally, right at the end, I met a young guy, a healthy young man, and because of my condition, obviously the conversation turned quickly to my health, and in no time he maintained he knew what was wrong with me. Not only that, he told me that he had had the same thing, and when he described what his condition had been, I knew without a doubt that he had had what I had, what I was suffering from now, because, he just described it so perfectly. And in fact, he was the first person in 10 years that I'd been able to relate to. And anyway, I was very excited when he told me that he had the cure and that he could give it to me and that I'd be cured in no time. And then I was very despondent when he told me what the cure was. I was very deflated, because he told me that the cure was to eat red meat and drink white wine and smoke cigarettes and drink coffee. You know, a couple of cups of coffee every day, a few cigarettes. He wasn't advocating, wholesale smoking or alcoholism or anything, but to have red meat every day and to drink some white wine with my meals and have a few cups of coffee. And, he stressed that I had to have a few cigarettes every day. Now, you laugh, and it is funny in retrospect, but you can imagine how horrifying that was to me at the time, because of the scores of people that I'd been to see, none of them knew what was wrong for me, but they all had advice about, what I should be doing and how I should be living, and all of them would have said to me, that is pure mumbo-jumbo. And that not only is it mumbo jumbo, but it is actually a prescription for suicide. And it's just a prescription for suicide. And
this is an amazing teaching experience, it must seem. First of all, I think you went through this trial, this ring of fire, for a reason, and I think that reason is not only benefiting you, I think it's benefiting of us. First of all, I want to say thank you for whatever circumstances, whatever agreement there was before you were a soul on this earth, that you would go through this for yourself, and thereby helping yourself, you're helping the rest of us. I want to thank you for that. You mentioned that the Swazis, they were understanding that this daily experience that we go through, I'm going to use the words on the surface, is just illusion. That reminds me something of Sanskrit, which they say that the world that we see in which we're living, it is all illusion. They call it Maya. They also tell us about the trials that we have to go through on the threshold to greater realizations. And they often refer to it, there are many terms for this around the world. One of them is karma yoga, where you actually have to go through certain trials. You go, the way out of difficulty is through it. That's samskara. And in the process, you then find the liberation that lies on the other side. If you do not go through that, you stay inside the ring of fire, and you are then constantly surrounded by trouble by seeking to avoid it and not going through it. You're never rid of it. So this is a parallel to what Joseph Campbell described as the hero's journey. Imagine your life as concentric circles of around yourself is your immediate family, then there's your friends, there's your community, and then there's the nation culture in which you live. And if you want to be Jonathan Livingston Seagull and fly higher and further and see greater distances on the horizon, you're not going to be a conformist with the flock. So you're going to have to be shunned by the people around you. You are picking up the ideas of the Swazi and learning these imaginative teachings that go beyond the cerebral wisdom. And yet you went to school and had your intelligence impeded by education, where they were teaching you to unlearn and be reprogrammed. So when the guy came along and told you to smoke, I'm relieved that we can laugh now. I do not mean to laugh at your pain, sir. But I laugh at a rapid release of anxiety as I hear the story, because you brought me to this point. And then, so here, have a glass of wine, smoke a cigarette. We'll talk over at a steak. And so tell me, how are you feeling? You got better. There you realize that what we conceive as being the way is not always the way, is it?
Well, precisely, you see, because here's the thing is, I got better really, really quickly. You know, I mean, I bounced back to health. I did take the man's prescription. I mean, as confronting as it was, you know, I very quickly reckoned that I didn't have anything to lose. I mean, I was already getting deathbed counseling, you know. Everything that I'd been, you know, told to do by all the medical professionals over 10 years hadn't stopped this inexorable downhill slide. And so, you know, I didn't have anything to lose. And also, I mean, because of the guy's story, there was an empathy and a believability and a trust. And so part of me was hoping that, you know, there's a slight chance that he might be right. But anyway, I took the prescription, I ate the meat, I drank the wine, I smoked the cigarettes, I drank the coffee, and, you know, it was the first time I'd had a bit of pleasure in my life in a long, long time. But more than that, I bounced back to health in days. You know, my energy was restored to me. It took me a few months for the sores on my body to heal up and the weight to come, you know, my full weight to be restored and that. But generally, I was healed. And in 20 years since then, that has never recurred, ever. I've not been revisited by that mysterious illness once. But the thing is, David, is that from that experience, you see, what I learned was, what I got out of it was, funnily enough, I never, ever believed there was any efficacy in the substances themselves. You know, I didn't ever believe that they actually did anything for me. What I was left with was, you know, just the blinding conclusion that there must be some way in which I focus that then, you know, determines how my, that determines my experience of life, determines the reality that I create. Because, you know, I mean, there's a lot I learned about myself through that experience, which we haven't got time to talk about now. But just broadly speaking, I just realized how focused I had been on being sick and not being sick and how, you know, I couldn't be sick. I mean, that was the whole thing running through my consciousness, my desperation not to be sick because of what I believed it meant to be sick, you know, about how I was basically, you know, unviable if I didn't have my full mental and physical faculties going for me. And so it's just something that I just continued to create in a magnified way until I was, you know, there I was on my deathbed basically. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's what I took away from it. That's what I got from it. I learned that there's some way in which our focus creates our reality. I didn't really know how it worked, but what it did for me, obviously I had a huge passion. I was so inspired by this realization, this experience and this realization, that for 20 years I've not tired of it, I've not bored. In fact, my fascination with this idea has only grown and grown. But, you know, right from back then, I determined to understand how this principle worked. Because I didn't at the time know exactly how it worked. And I wanted to learn how it worked so that I could then use it to self-consciously create my heaven on earth instead of my hell on earth. And so, you know, so I did. And because of that powerful experience and my strong intention and desire to learn, I mean, the lessons also were attracted to me very quickly. And then, you know, full circle, I came back full circle to my early childhood in Swaziland because, you know, as it turns out then, is that the way in which I now live and create and teach other people to live and create is to have that ability to see through self-conscious, waking, linear, material reality through to what's really going on within inside of us, and know to be aware of the forces at play and where the power is in our consciousness, and then to have the power, the self-conscious power, the self-conscious ability to align our will with the forces that we, you know are going to lead to good outcomes in our lives, to put the power in the places where it's going to be most effective in creating what really matters to us in life and is in alignment with our highest possibility and our highest destiny, and that serves us in the highest way. And everything also, and to me, most importantly, actually, is not just about us, but that we serve the whole that we're a part of, that we serve our society and our environment through living in the most powerful way that's available for us to live, as far as I'm aware so far. If someone can show me a more powerful way, I'll hop on it so quickly, your head will spin.
Well, my head is already spinning, William, because you said that focus creates reality. Is it possible that the magic we're seeking, that we would travel to distant lands, look, see, want to have demonstrated, is really a force that's within us already?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's just so palpably clear that everything that happens in our lives is as a direct result of where our attention is. I mean, people can argue that all they like, but, you know, whenever they come and do work with me, is I can deconstruct things for them so that they can, you know, see without a doubt. And it's not me just bamboozling them and hypnotizing them, but that they can really appreciate and actually even in almost like a logical way, well, in a logical way, just see how what they pay attention to, what they focus on, actually leads to the results that is now their experience of life, is their experience of reality, and nothing else other than the way they pay attention, because you can show them time and time again the correspondence between what they're paying attention to really and what is going on in their life really, and it's always the same. So we really do always, you know, we're always creating our own reality, our own experience of life. We actually, you know, we're creating machines. That machine is always running. It never stops. It's just whether you can become conscious of you know, the creating machine within you and conscious of what it is creating and conscious of whether it's creating what you want it to create or not. But we are always creating. Our focus is always creating our reality. But that's not what I'm really here to teach people, David, is because I think that's kind of commonly understood now. That's almost commonly accepted. Certainly, people widely know that as a theory anyway, and a lot of people subscribe to it or would like to subscribe to it. But you know, how it's being held right now, which I'm hoping I've got a deeper contribution to make, because how it's being held now is in a very simplistic way, which is that, well, if there's things that we want, all we have to do is imagine them and affirm them in some way, either through incantations or vision boards up on our walls, or, you know, in whatever form that we informing our imagination of what it is we want, and then those things will float into our life. But with the law of attraction having been, you know, widely promulgated now, and the secret, you know, being widely circulated, you know, there now is a lot of data coming back of people who have been working on with these principles for a few years, and what the findings actually are is that, because I travel the world and I talk to thousands of people and I do talk back radio, and I know that the truth is that for most people, this is a very hit and miss idea and a very hit and miss practice that, you know, mm-hmm. for the vast majority of people, most probably doesn't work. A lot of people even report that their lives go backwards, and an equal number of people say, well, you know, it works sometimes, sometimes it doesn't work. It's just all very random. And the thing is, and I, you know, this is what I'm saying, is what I believe my contribution is to offer up this principle, which I've studied, you know, for 20 years now, and really looked at the determinants of what works and doesn't work. And, you know, I'm just here to support people in appreciating the deeper levels of these principles and being able to work them at these deeper levels. Because, you know, while it is true that what you focus on, you know, creates your reality, what you think you're focused on is mostly not what you really focused on.
Illusion again.
It is. You know, we're subject to illusions. And that's why The Last Shaman is a very important book. Because it goes back to what I was saying is, you know, I was born into this. Unbeknownst to me, I only realized it in retrospect, I was born into magic. In the sense, I was born into this culture that didn't take their illusion for granted. They were preoccupied with looking beyond it, looking through it to see what's really going on at a deeper level and understanding it on that level, and then dealing with their lives and the world from that level.
This almost reminds me of something from cinema. You know, William Shakespeare said that all the world is stage and men and women merely players upon it. And critics will say something about a film performance in cinema. Someone may say, wow, that person's doing a really good job of acting. Or it applies to theater, too. But they'll say, if you are aware that the person is acting, then they're not really that good of an actor. So that's a parallel. And it's when you just get involved with the story, and you're not, it becomes transparent to you that the direction, the editing, the camera work, the acting is all very good, then that's really there. So if we let our egos get in the way and we forget that let's say is on the surface is really just what we're doing through, it's not what we are, then we can get too focused on that and become as strung out as a performer that has to take drugs in order to keep doing those shows. And I can name you famous rock stars that have fatally burned out because they had to keep up what's on stage instead of focusing on, you know, what the music that they're playing is about. And that's on the deeper level. And the deeper level gets us beyond illusions, so that you say that the law of attraction and the secret, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Well, sometimes we're clear and sometimes we see illusion. There's an old Chinese saying that says, be careful what you wish for. It may come true. Well, yeah, we see some of that in the law of attraction. But we also got to remember that in the process of that, we got to get through illusion and have realization. And realization, beyond knowing, realization brings things into action. That's the eternal law of the universe, action, reaction, and response. So when you have your focus creating your reality and that reality turns into realization, that turns it into action, and that makes a difference. Because the Chinese also have another saying, a man must stand on the side of a hill with his mouth open for a long time before a rose duck fly into it. So in any case, when we learn a little bit about the deeper realities and we get out of our concepts and our realities of it, I so enjoyed living through the lead character, Mark Vail here, who had to, you know, contrast this juxtaposition of what he taught and what he knew against what he was learning. That's absolutely. So this is something that we can all learn. And you also, and as well as introducing us to some of the magnificent wonders that have been passed down through the ages and that we're sort of rediscovering now in the cycles of time in the world. This is where the world trends are going. One of the reasons why I wanted this type of teaching to come on the cycles of change, it's a bellwether for where we're headed, William. And I think that you're one of the leaders in teaching for what everyone is seeking and simultaneously recognizing as all boats rise with the tide of these rising energies post-machine age. But you also warn us of some of the dangers out there. There's something you refer to in the book called the Hitler effect. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I don't want anyone to be put off or intimidated by a notion like the Hitler effect. It can sound quite dramatic, but really it's just a metaphor that one of the characters, well, it's actually Mark Vail, uses in the story to explain to someone else exactly what we're looking at now. You see, is that if you look at and the example he uses is Hitler, and he says if you look at Hitler and you see his lust for power and his grab for power, that initially he was very successful and he had great initial success and he acquired a lot of power initially, but then if you look at, you know, his trajectory in history, you also appreciate that he had a huge fall, that he had a great fall, and that he was completely annihilated, and his whole race was just absolutely crushed at the end of it. And him and all the people around him, and that, and what Mark Vail was saying is, well, if you look at what drove him, it's just an historical fact that, I mean, his ambition was fueled by his own deep sense of personal sense of worthlessness, shame, and powerlessness, you see. And so all of his warmongering was designed to compensate for that. And you see, this goes back to what we were saying before, is that what you focus on, you create. And you see, if he's lusting for power, as he was, and he was focused on power, that initial superficial focus won through, and he did achieve initial success. And you see this in people's creative arcs, because I work with people, I've worked with thousands of people for many years on their creative process. I'm not someone who's just here doing a counseling session, helping you see things in a different way for a few weeks or something. The way I work is I work with people over years and years, and I've worked with people typically for a minimum of 2 years, and some people I've worked with and observed for a period of up to 15 years. So, I'm very familiar with people's creative processes and how often you can see an initial success as the initial superficial focus wins through and is attracted. But you see, all the time, the part of us that is creating our reality, if we go, we're creating our reality, then and the powers within us, and we're creating that, then there's a premise for what that part of us is. And, it is really a mystery, and so we just talk about it conceptually as a premise and have different languages for it. And, some people call it the feminine principle or the subconscious or the imagination, even some people call it the universe. But that part of us that is looking at what is getting a picture of what we're focused on and then creating a reality to reflect that, well, that part of us is not just looking at the superficial focus. It's looking at the full depth of consciousness and looking to see where the power is in our consciousness. So it's not just looking at the pretty pictures of what we'd love, millions of dollars or worldwide domination in the case of Hitler, or, a beautiful woman on our lap, or whatever it is. It's not looking at that. It's looking at the full depth of our consciousness and where the power is. And so, you see, what we are choosing and aspiring to in our life is motivated by deeper levels of consciousness. And our subconscious, or whatever you want to call that part of us that creates, is looking at, as I said, at that full depth of consciousness, including what's motivating our choices in life and our aspirations in life and our desires in life. And you know, often that is where the power is in these insecurities that we're seeking to compensate for, just like in Hitler's case, where what he was doing was compensating for this deep sense of shame, humiliation, powerlessness, and you know, in the end, that's what won out, and that was the end result that was created. And so, too, in our lives, you see, the thing is that when we're born and we individuate, our identities are created, our illusion of separation, our sense of having an individual sense of existence and being, which is to a large part an illusion, because actually our natures are in fact inherently connected. But to have an individual sense of existence, we take on an illusion of separation. We manufacture a sense of individual existence, and that happens in the earliest phase of our life. And to do that, our egos actually create that sense of separation, by taking on beliefs of limitation, beliefs that hold that we're incomplete, that we're separate, and that we're limited. And that's great, because it gives us our personalities, it gives us our individuality, etc. But the side effect is that it leaves us with a sense, and an illusory sense, but to us a very real sense of limitation, of separation, and no notion that we're incomplete, that we're not good enough, that we're not worthy, that we're not capable, that we don't have the capacity, that we can't trust, that we're not safe, that we're not perfect, you know, whatever it is to us and our personality type. And the thing is then is that we get caught up in a cycle of needing to resolve our identities. We want to compensate for our sense of limitation, our sense of incompleteness, and that becomes actually the hidden agenda, and the unconscious meaning of our lives is to resolve our identities. And so we're striving to get away from that, but the problem is that then that's where the power can be in our consciousness, and that's what we can be lending the energy to, is those notions of separation, those notions of limitation, and then thereby perpetuating that. And here's the problem with these, you know, schools of teaching people that their focus creates reality, and that if they just focus on what they want and you know, learn to see very clearly what they want and hold that very clearly in their minds and feel very strongly that they can have that, then they can have that. But they're not teaching people that they could be practicing the Hitler effect, in other words, that they could just be, that what they're directed by, what they're motivated by, could be there, and usually is when people start out and begin. Usually what people want is to resolve their identity and fix up what they believe needs to be fixed about themselves, which then only just perpetuates their identity and their personalities, their dysfunctional personalities.
I see. And so as we seek to identify who we are, we seek to define it by what we do. And when you magnify it to the extreme, as in the case of rare individuals in history, such as the Hitler effect, it's an amplification of things that can be part, and a very small part, of our daily lives. And if you say, well, I'll show them, well, you're not really going to win, because once you engage in that battle, you have already lost by virtue of the fact you're engaging regardless of the outcome. So, yes.
Exactly.
And so we can go beyond that. You know, Dante said that hell is the place for those too attached to their fears and desires who can't pass on to eternity. So if thoughts and feelings aren't real and we mistake them for real and we try to resolve those feelings in an illusion of the theater that isn't necessarily real, it's only the arena through which we come to embark upon a greater reality, then we're not really going to understand, you know, everything that's going on until we get onto that deeper level. And this is what is so moving, because I kept feeling like I was there. I have confabulated memories of experiences and scenes by reading your book, and I'm going, oh, no, I wasn't there. That was in the book. Have you ever heard anybody say something like that to you? You know, it's almost as if I were actually there, because you were really telling the story. You have been asked if the lead character in this book, Mark Vail, is in fact you. Have you not been asked that question?
Oh yeah, well, all the time. I mean, people assume it's me. You know, I've even with the original book, with The Magician's Way, I even got hate mail because of you know, the character's trajectory in that story, and what he goes through. People have so identified me with the story that they've written to me telling me, you know, what a bad person I am for having done the things that Mark Vail did in the book, you know. I'm going, you know, my name's William Whitecloud, his name's Mark Vail, that was a story, you know, and people can't get over that it's not me in some cases, but it's not
hey,
me.
William,
but, you know,
when people know you're writing fiction, you're not really writing fiction.
Well,
it'll take off. If, when people know that you're acting, you're not really acting that well.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, you know, of course everyone wants to know to what degree is the main character my character, and quite honestly, the answer is, I fancy myself as a bit of a student of personality typing, and so whenever I do write a book, I do frame up the characters according to certain personality types to give them a richer depth and consistency, basically, and you know, a sense of quality of character. And Mark Vail is not my personality type. I know my personality type very well, and you know, I know Mark Vail's personality type because I constructed it, and we are not the same personality. Although, you know, we both come from Africa, and also, while I have not literally been through what he has been through, every scene in The Last Shaman, not so much the Magician's Way, but I can honestly say that every scene in The Last Shaman is based on a setting that I have witnessed, have been in, and mostly actually lived in, and also based on characters or composite of characters that I have known, and also based on incidents that I have experienced, either more or less extremely, but, you know, and not necessarily in that order or anything. But, you know, I've really drawn on The Last Shaman in particular. I've drawn very strongly on my own experience, but
yes,
it mustn't be confused for my journey or my story or my character. I'm not responsible for the actions of Mark Vail.
No, but evidently you had to have lived in Africa to be able to create the scenes, to understand the character of the people there, the interplays between the different peoples, the subtleties, the nuances that come through in your very well-worded descriptions. You had to be able to have these tools in order to create this fictitious story. This fictitious story just resonates. On your way there of giving us this wonderful tale through which we can live vicariously, through which we can learn to overcome our negative beliefs, you found trials and experiences along the way. And one of the things that helped you preceding this book was the concept of hermetic philosophy. What is that, William?
Well, hermetic philosophy is just basically a strand of alchemy, but when I say just basically, I'm most probably downplaying it, because it's the strand of alchemy that I came across. I was saying before how when I discovered that there's this idea that your focus creates your reality, and wanted to learn more about how that worked, I was attracted to certain philosophies and modalities. And I think that the main one was hermetic philosophy. And, you know, at the time, I didn't really appreciate it other than the principles that I was learning. But subsequently, I've come to understand through other scholars that I've now been taught by and whom I've studied, that they all respect, you know, as students of alchemy, they all respect Hermetic philosophy as kind of the alchemy par excellence. You know, it's the most excellent strand of alchemy that there is. And, you know, everyone understands the metaphorical idea of alchemy, that it's about turning lead into gold, and that even that that in turn is a metaphor for shifting from our egoic based identity to, you know, our higher side of ourselves, to our higher self, and to be able to identify with that side of ourselves and also operate from that side of ourselves. And so Hermetic philosophy really is a kind of a mind science. It's a very transformative technology. Mm-hmm. It's techniques that enable you to transform, to turn your own personal lead into gold, to shift from an ego-based identity to quite literally a soul orientation. And also, you know, because of that, because of those same techniques that create that extraordinary, that is available there to create that extraordinary shift within yourself,
mm-hmm.
those very principles are the exact principles by which you can create anything that you want in life. They actually, it's manifesting technology. So the whole thing is that you will not ever shift by any rational function. You see, I think it was Einstein who said, was it not, that the mind that created a problem can't solve the problem. So, you know, the mind, the side of yourself that formed your ego, developed your ego, gave you your belief systems and, you know, is responsible for your compensating tendencies and your whole egoic orientation, that is not the side of yourself that's going to liberate you from that. It's dedicated to holding you in that, what you before, I think, called the ring of fire, David. It's dedicated to holding you in that. So you're going to hand over to something else that's going to facilitate that transformation. And that's why I was saying to you before, my definition of magic is the idea that we have a creative spirit that we can hand over to, that can facilitate manifestations, creations beyond what we could rationally conceive of. Because in my experience, David Hawkins says this in Power Versus Force, that they can calibrate consciousness on a level of from, you know, 0 to 1,000. And he says that most typically, people are at some whatever level of consciousness, and that no matter what they do, that no matter what spirituality they subscribe to, no matter what personality personal development they undertake, they will not transform more than 5 points on that whole scale. So I think that's 0.5%. And he's saying no matter what anyone does, In terms of the scale of their consciousness, they will not evolve more than 0.5% in their life, which is, you know, an astonishing thing to say. But I can totally believe it, because everything we do, we're doing it, and we're doing it from our rational framework. We're doing it from our rational, materialistic, linear framework. We're trying to evolve and be spiritual from the egoic side of ourselves, and so to effect transformation and effect change, to create anything, is we have to have the ability to hand over to a higher side of ourselves that can, that be beyond our understanding, that can then affect that change. And Hermetic philosophy is the science of that technique, of that technology, of that ability to identify what it is that we want, and then engage our creative spirit in supporting us in creating what we want. And at the end of the day, the thing that we want actually more than anything else, we might think that we want a whole bunch of material things, which you know, there's nothing wrong with material things, but it's actually not what we want for the most part. For the most part, a lot of what we want is just to, you know, resolve our identity and make ourselves feel complete and secure, when in fact, really, if we connect with our divine nature, with our authentic nature, with our higher self, we're going to find that we're already complete, and that there's a whole bunch of things, a whole bunch of expressions that are there waiting for us that really matter to us, that we really care about. And at the end of the day, that is where, you know, our true joy lies and our true wealth lies, and our true efficiency in life lies. And you know, at the end of the day, that is really what we want. The first thing we want, not from our identity, not from our egos, but from our hearts, what we really would love is to become who we really are and operate from that. And that is something that has to be created. And it's not going to happen accidentally. I think it's happened spontaneously with a very few and exceptional characters in history. For the most part, most of us are going to create that. And Hermetic philosophy is the secrets and the art and the technology for creating that. But foremost for, you know, creating change, for creating transformation within ourselves, that then, you know, enables us to be powerful creators in all areas of our lives, in what really, you know, is truly significant to us and truly matters to us. And it's, you know, look, it's a beautiful science, and I feel very privileged and very fortunate that I discovered it so quickly after the realizations I had through my illness. I mean, I came upon, from being cured, I stumbled across Hermetic philosophy within months of that. And so it's almost like it was meant to be. I was meant to have the suffering I had, make the realization I make, and then mm-hmm. be offered this technology that is, you know,
yes.
I've studied for 20 years, David, looking at you know, the depths of these matters that we're talking about now, and I have not found anything as pure or powerful or that just comes close to being as powerful and a complete and comprehensive model. Can I just say one more thing? Is that
you can, you say know, more than that, sir? Please do.
I love listening to you, David. I've got to be honest. I just so enjoy, you know, when you talk, and I just go, I wish he could speak. He knows so much more than me. But I'll just say this, you know, is that, you know, like about Hermetic philosophy, it's, oh look, it doesn't matter. It's just the greatest thing. And this is what I wanted to say about it, is that with so many models that you look at, you bring me any sort of spiritual or personal development model. Because I'm an expert in personal personality typing, I can actually show you the personality that model expresses. Mm-hmm. I can show you the personality type that evolved that model, whether it's a profoundly spiritual model or not, or whether, you know, it's just a philosophy for, you know, a model for making money, or a relationship model, whatever. If you look at anything, you look at things structurally, you'll see the personality type that evolved it, which means it is actually at some level evolved out of ego, because it you know, it's based from a slant of a certain belief system. But if you take Hermetic philosophy, you will not be able to identify the personality system behind it. It is devoid of any structures that you will ever identify as personality. It's devoid of any beliefs or anything. It holds no belief systems whatsoever. It's just a set of premises,
yeah,
that it does not identify with, and it only says, you know, Hermetic philosophy only says, these are premises. This is not even the truth. This is not even reality. These are just premises, and that if you use these premises you will get certain results that will take you somewhere, and then, you know, you'll have the power and you'll know from there. But this is nothing. It's not even a belief system. It's an extraordinary system, I'm telling you, that I believe is divinely inspired. It's absolutely divinely inspired for that reason.
It serves as a first step, though, does it not? Because first we need to understand the abstract principles involved. And then once we identify that these things do exist, that they are there, and that we can define them in one way or another, then we get to learn how to use them as tools and even what's in it for me. So how does this become applied realization? Now, you do From Greatness Transformational Workshops. You're based in California, are you not, William?
Well, I am now. I live in Palo Alto. I keep saying that, and that's why people keep saying that I live in Palo Alto. I used to have an office in Palo Alto. I live in Santa Monica now, and have done for a few months, and plan to be here for at least a few years. And yes, I'm ready to launch my work here at the moment. I actually don't have any dates at the moment because I'm actually going over to London to work this month, and I'm just refining some of my seminars, my products, and I'm very close to finishing that. And as soon as I've done that, me and my team are going to sit down and create a bunch of dates, and I'm going to start touring the United States and giving people an insight into what we've been talking about here, but only in a very practical way.
Well, we're going to continue to let people know about your upcoming tours as they develop in the products and the development tools that you're putting in a way that we can understand and learn from you. And folks, you're listening to blogtalkradio.com/cycles, the Cycles of Change radio program, talking with William Whitecloud. We're going to keep everyone posted of your calendar as they come up, because when I read The Last Shaman, I realize that there is more than what we're used to, and I sort of get it. You know, there's a description of the Tao, and this is from ancient scriptures itself, that understanding the Tao is like getting a joke, and it really sometimes comes down to you either get it or you don't. And as I start to have these awakenings and sometimes these explosions, as I get it, living through the story, which is in a way a story of us all. And then I want to know, how can I put this into my life? How can I make this be part of the way, my way? And what you're doing with the Living From Greatness Transformational Workshops would be of great benefit. Now, you've been doing this sort of work for many, many years, you say. You've taught on continents all over the world, haven't you?
I have. I've been, teaching and refining my model for 19 years now. You know, I came across it 20 years ago. It wasn't long after I'd applied it to my own life. I came to teaching and everything I do now, actually, in a sense, in an accidental way, because once I had my own personal transformation and learned what I, the fundamentals anyway, the basics of what I know and today and began applying them. I mean, my life began changing very quickly. And, a lot of people who had known me were, quite amazed at the transformation they saw in me. I mean, recognizing the healing journey that I'd gone on physically, and then also the change in my life subsequently, once I started applying my creative premises to my own life, people started asking me how I could help them and what I could teach them. And I started teaching in a very modest way, but then those teachings and the popularity of them began spreading very quickly, and before I knew it, I was doing trainings and then I was writing books and so on, and so till today now that I've always through that remained very intensely curious about change and passionate about the fact that people can really create magnificent lives for them, that that also that, you know, it's not just about having, you know, just what you can get and have in life, but the fact that, you know, we all are, you know, spiritual beings living a human experience, and that we all are capable of getting in touch with who we really are, and the joy of that, and living soul-inspired lives. And so that is what I'm dedicated to empowering people in, and you know, is what all my work is based on. But you know, also not just that. There's something also unique to my own mindset, which is for some reason I'm just very curious as to perfecting what it's really about and how it really works, you know, and what it really takes, and distinguishing the myths and the confusions in the whole, you know, field, and crystallizing it down to its essence and the core. And you know, my first book, for instance, The Magician's Way, its subtitle was What It Really Takes to Find Your Treasure, and that could be the subtitle of all of my work, David. Is, you know, I'm absolutely concerned and dedicated to delivering to people what it really takes, you know, the most effective, powerful way in which to connect with yourself and create in line with your spirit and create in line with, you know, what your spirit truly would love, you know, to effect on planet Earth, basically.
Your hidden treasure. I like that. You know, if I were to travel around the world seeking treasures, because I'm envious of the treasures of others, and I go looking for pirate maps and trying to dig where X marks the spot, and I go searching for all of these things outside of myself, I might one day be like Citizen Kane on my deathbed, whispering moments before I die, Rosebud, trying to remember sled from my childhood, because in the last moments, in that filter of closing your life out, only the most valuable things will be evident to you then. As you're losing everything around you, you're losing your life, you're losing your ability to control, you realize losing your grasp over all the possessions you acquired, then you realize the old adage that the emptier the drum, the louder the echo. And that will echo within us. Will it be something that we had long forgotten, things that we realized and wished for in our childhood, but put these things aside as our intelligence was impeded by education and sought through the illusion of life for material gains? But what does it profit a man to gain the world but lose his soul? And when we realize that when we actually do get to where we can find the hidden treasure, we haven't left where we are right now. And I'm beginning to get a little bit of that when I read The Last Shaman.
Yeah, no, that's right. Because I mean, the whole thing is the thing to appreciate is that we're already whole, we're already complete, we're already ready to go. You know, and the big misconception that we can all be colluding in is preparing to live. You know, that everyone's preparing to live, and life is right here. You know, waiting for us to actually live now, right in the moment. You know, and you know, if I can just recommend people to my website, williamwhitecloud.com, because there they'll find a whole heap of resources that relate to living your life in the soul-inspired way that we're talking about now. There are free chapters to my books. There's articles, blogs. There's a newsletter you can sign up and you know, not only receive interesting information, but if anyone's interested in hearing me talk personally and coming and doing some practical work with me, then, you know, these dates will be informed through that medium as well. And, yeah, it's just a great site, great place to start.
WilliamWhiteCloud.com. Spell the way it sounds, all one word. There is videos there. In fact, it was viewing the video on your homepage that I knew instantly that you were real. You got Pinterest links. You're also on Twitter. And there's just a world of things there, from the store, the community section, the events, the different resources, how to contact you, and folks, really, The Last Shaman is a book that's very well worth reading. I'll be moving on to your first work after this one, which is I've just finished reading your book, and now I'm going to go on to The Magician's Way, which is the first one that you wrote. But I hope that you're planning perhaps another sequel, a trilogy. Are you considering that, William?
I am, but don't expect it too soon. I mean, I've got to assimilate this one first and get this one going out there and have
it. What a monumental achievement. It absolutely is. It absolutely is.
Thanks. No, appreciate that. And you've got a copy of The Magician's Way, haven't you not?
Well, I got it from you, and you sent it to me.
That's right.
I thank you for that, and because this book is just absolutely moving. I do expect it to wind up being a film coming up one of these ways. Listeners, I want you to know that one of the main reasons that I asked Mr. Whitecloud to join us tonight is not just because of the quality of this book, and this is my number one recommendation, but because it is relevant to the cycles of times. Those of you who listen to the Cycles of Change radio program know that we've been talking about how we have moved away from the military industrial complex and that the machine age is slowly ending. The heyday, the high period of it, is already over. The physical high cycle, as I call it, that brought us materialism, territoriality, a sense of acquisition, and defense of borders, and the building of walls, and the competition between nations. Now what we're doing is we're moving away from that as it goes down, and we're cleaning up the industrial mess that we created. What are we moving on to? Some things are obvious. The information age, the rise of what I call the intellectual cycle, and the rise of the Orient every half millennium, to rise and fall as the intellectual cycle rises and falls. But you know what's not as evident is the new age of romanticism, because simultaneously rising with the intellectual ascent is the emotional cycle that is giving us a new spirit and a new sense of spirituality. And in the process of that, it is giving us a new awareness. And as we develop that, become more aware on a subtle level, we become more aware of states of being within us. And in so doing, leading the way is a wonderful tale of one fictional character who went through that journey that I think typifies what we are all doing right now. Folks, this has been the Cycles Change Radio program, speaking with author William Whitecloud on his latest book, The Last Shaman. Find him on williamwhitecloud.com and check back on his site for his tours and upcoming books and development tools and events. William, thank you so much for joining us on The Cycles of Change.
David, thanks so much. I thoroughly enjoy my conversations with you. Love listening to you, and look forward to many more conversations in the future.
Well, I think popular demand is going to weigh in and ask that you come back. So look for us. Keep a view on the Cycles of Change, folks, because we're going to be inviting Mr. Whitecloud to join us again. I'm David Katzmeier, your host, signing out for this program. Thank you for listening.